Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go!
The barbell hasn't changed in over 100 years. I can take a 25-pound plate, and we'll go out on the turf, and I'll have you hating life. We talk about straining your gut, pushing past that comfort level. I want a lot of energy.
What better breeding ground is there for being a success in life than the weight room?
Hey guys, welcome back to Iron Game Chalk Talk. I'm your host, Ron McKeefrey, and this is episode number 228. I want to thank you guys for listening each week. Really appreciate those of you that like, share, comment, and just help spread the word about the amazing coaches that we have on the show. Also want to thank our sponsors, and specifically Sornex and Adam and myself for just, I mean, we think so highly of Sornex and the people there and the company. If you have any experiences with Bert or the gang, you know that they're just first-class individuals in every single way. And so really appreciate them for sponsoring this episode for free for you guys. This week I'm joined by Adam Nelson. I'm sure you guys all are familiar and see his face and know who he is, but he's a 2004 gold medalist. He's also the CFO, COO of the D10, which we'll get into a little bit, but just a great friend and good quality human being, man. I appreciate you coming on the show.
Oh, it's a pleasure, Ron. Thanks for having me.
Adam, you know, I've heard you speak a million times. We've talked a handful other times, but one of the, I always just love hearing the story about kind of how you went from, you know, this guy to, you know, an Ivy League grad and an Olympic athlete. But how did, you know, going back, how did you find the weight room and what kind of role has the weight room had in your life?
Yeah, so, you know, every time I get asked a question kind of like this, how I found the weight room, it changes. I think my answer changes because I remember more about those times. You know, I was in eighth grade. I just moved back from Virginia to Atlanta into a new school. And I'd always, like, I don't know, I watched Rocky when I was growing up. I was a huge Hulk Hogan fan growing up. And I thought, like, you know, getting big was going to be awesome. I didn't realize that Sylvester Stallone was so small at the time. But so I found the weight room early. And my dad took me in there. I can remember, like, just trailing around with him, working out with him. But really what happened, I think the biggest moment in my life happened because of a pretty significant failure, at least in my mind. It was the spring of my eighth grade year, and I was already in the weight room on a regular basis, but this is kind of what solidified it. I went out for baseball, and new program, new school. The program was, I think they'd won state champs like 4 or 5 years in a row at the high school level. It was a K-12 school, and so they were really established, and I thought, well, you know, this is going to be awesome. I'll be a part of this team and be great and go out for day one. And day one at this school, you know, you make it through the tryouts of day one. That's kind of like, I probably shouldn't call it this, but I call it fat cut day. Like, you know, you just don't have it.
Right.
And it was my first day, like I said, on tryouts, and the coach calls me in afterwards, and I'm thinking, oh, well, this is going to be good. He's going to give me the attaboy speech. And he looks at me, he goes, Adam, you're just not good enough. And Coach Tim Schaefer, he had a bit of a stutter, and he told me I wasn't good enough, and I would never be good enough. And I was in eighth grade at the time, and that's a pretty harsh thing to hear when you're 12 or 13 years old. But I saw it as a blessing in disguise because football was my passion. I said, oh, this is going to be great. I'm going to train for football. It's going to be great. Go home. My dad says, I tell my dad my grand plan. I said, look, I got cut from baseball, but I'm going to spend this time wisely. I'm going to get in the weight room. Anyway, my dad looks at me and he says, well, you could, or you could get a job. And as I tell people, the jobs in Atlanta, Georgia in 1988, 1989 for 12 or 13 year old boys were not very good options. And there's more to that. I ended up finding the track program and then finding a way to basically do the training that I wanted to do 2 hours a day and then go throw and run and lift and all that stuff. It was fantastic. But my weight room story, I mean, there was no supervision in our weight room. And it was an awesome place to just go and experiment and learn from well-intentioned but totally misinformed other teenagers. And we did everything wrong and we did everything right. You know, I think the things that we did wrong were sort of you would look at it as a strength coach, an educated strength coach, and say, oh, man.
Right.
But then you look at it from the uneducated side, and you'd say, wow, these kids are putting in the time, the effort, the energy, the sweat, the blood, the tears, whatever you want to say. And we were in there every single day. And there was a system of accountability. There was a system of hard work and ethic, just a place to just – you kind of just went in there and you had the opportunity to learn and grow and really fail a lot. And our motto was really simple. Like, it's like, if you could lift something, you know, you add a little bit more weight. And if you could lift that, then you add a little bit more weight. And so without even realizing it, I got exposed to this concept of progressive loading and some other things. And I look back on all the things that we did wrong back there, and I kind of laugh because – I tell people as well, I said my greatest strength as an athlete was my ability to endure without injury during that learning curve. So fortunately, I don't think a lot of kids have to go through that as much anymore. Maybe they do, but not quite the same.
Unfortunately, more than we would like to admit, I would imagine. But you know what? Yeah. There is. I agree with you. There is a certain level of, you know, that self-discovery that you have to go through when you don't have, you know, that constant coaching in your ear about technique. I remember same thing. So in high school, I was first time doing 225 and I freaking get pinned by it, you know, and I'm sitting there and my spotter left to go talk to somebody. I'm sitting there and I'm like, okay, well, I'm not crushed, so how do I get rid of this type thing?
But
at that point, then it was like, okay, well, the worst that could happen is it's just going to sit on my chest for a little bit, you know? And,
yeah.
I think that's something that we do need to, as coaches, we need to allow there to be that little bit of self-discovery as you go, because it definitely played an important part in your life, and I think probably all of us can point to something like that as well. As you've gone through your career as an athlete or as a coach, you know, what's been one of the biggest mistakes that you've made and kind of how you learned from it?
Oh, geez. So the problem is I made a lot of mistakes.
We all have. Yeah. I usually preface that by saying, you know, not before breakfast, because I made three before breakfast this morning.
So, I'd say like the first big mistake, and I think a lot of athletes go through this, is we get to an age where we think we know everything. And I certainly went through that. I think that I knew more than the coaches, and I based that based off how much I could lift or how fast I could run versus and jump versus other people in my position or other people in my age. And that was a lot of arrogance there. That's not even confidence. That's just arrogance, because you realize that after being alive for 42 years, you realize that, you know, not results don't necessarily correlate with knowledge base. Sometimes it's just blind luck or good genes or a combination of both, and not intention. So that'd be the first thing. I think the second mistake I made was not being intentional necessarily with like every action outside of like what we were doing in the moment. So I was always very focused I think very focused on whatever the task at hand was. But once I left the playing field, once I left the weight room, sometimes my lifestyle choices didn't line up with what my career or even my short-term ambitions were. And I mean, I joke about this stuff now, but like, you know, I remember hearing Jed Logan use a term at SummerStrong saying he experimented with, what do you call it? He tested the limits and pushed the limits and everything, including figuring out what the appropriate level was for the social alcoholic or something like that. I can't remember the exact term. But, you know.
Functioning alcoholic, I think.
Yeah, something like that. And you know, I think there's a tendency when we're in college to explore and to push limits on a lot of things. And I wish that I'd gone, looking back, like I was, again, I think my greatest strength as a person or athlete was to, you know, endure a lot of stupid behavior and not come out with too many injuries or anything that was completely debilitating. But then the third thing, which is kind of like this whole concept of intention, is not knowing exactly what I wanted. And I know that sounds kind of weird, But it's very easy for me to say, well, I want to train for the 2000 Olympic Games. I want to train for the 2004 Olympic Games. That's very easy. But I remember I had a guy come to me, and this is part of my story, but he flew down to see me on his own plane in Athens, Georgia.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't know anything about the guy. This is really, it doesn't necessarily predate the internet, but the internet wasn't as quite, it wasn't as useful with doing, you know, the Google stalking and such. He came down and he point blank asked me, he said, what can I do to help you? What can, and he's like, is it a check? Is it, you know, what is it? And I didn't have a good answer for that. And the reason why I didn't have a good answer for that was maybe I'd blame it on like humility or pridefulness or whatever it is. But what I realized is one of the biggest mistakes we make as athletes or maybe as individuals is not being able to answer that question. And it's a lot easier for people in whether it's knowledge-based or resource-based or whatnot to help you if you can tell them what you need. And once you define that need, it's amazing how many people will come out of the woodworks to help you fill it. Particularly if you're a good person. I mean, if you're not a good person, you get what you, you know, you might as well just go play the lottery because that's about what you're going to get in support. I found that once I was able to be intentional with everything that I asked, finding the answers to the problems or the questions that I had was a lot easier. And I don't know if that was any specific thing necessarily, but those are the mistakes that I probably made early on quite often.
Yeah, I think you and I were talking off camera about, what we've been able to blend our passions with our job, you know, and I think you're right. I think coaches not knowing what the end in mind, you know, keeping the end in mind and working backwards from that and mm-hmm. knowing what your obstacles that are in your way of achieving that are is a common mistake. You know, I think we just live in the moment as coaches so much that and athletes and coaches, we just focus on the next winter, the next summer, the next whatever, when we do have to do a better job of thinking 4, 5, 10, you know, 10 years down the mm-hmm. line or 20 years down the line and work backwards. And I think, making sure that you align your passions with that is the critical element. But no, I appreciate you sharing that. You've dealt with some adversity in your career, you know, both, you know, as an athlete, as a person and the whole deal. And I think all of us can relate to that in our own personal journeys. You know, I think the story, if I'm not mistaken, I mean, you won a silver medal in the 2000 Olympics, the favorite for the 2004 Olympics, and ultimately end up getting silver again. And you go on to in just a great way, talk about the adversity that you dealt with in that situation, but then to turn around and I go through the Atlanta airport almost, I go through the Atlanta airport probably twice a week. You know, and every time I go to the airport, I think of your story and how you were able to ultimately get your gold medal through that. But share a little bit of that story. But more, what I'd like for you to dial in on is, as coaches, we have an obligation to our athletes to challenge and put our athletes in adverse situations so they can handle adversity when the bullets are flying. But when there is that level of buy-in and commitment and then the adversity does happen, how best can a coach be there for their athlete?
Right. To answer the first question, I think you kind of touched on it earlier. What's the role of a strength coach? A strength coach builds strong foundations. That's what you guys do. That's what we do. We look forward where we want to take this one player, this one team, and we look forward and we say, where do we want, what's that distance? And then we work backwards and say, what do we need for that athlete, that player, that team, whoever it is, whichever entity it is, to get from point A to point B. And so you build these strong foundations. And those foundations, for me, you know, some of them are coachableness and some of them aren't. Like, obviously, if you start with really poor material, there's only so much you can do when the gene pool limits you on day one. So you've got to have that good gene pool to begin with. But on top of that, there's work ethic. And I remember the guy that actually flew down to visit me in Athens, he drew a triangle, and he said, you can understand everything you need to know about people by looking at this triangle. And he said, there's three types of the triangle gets drawn, and at the top there's desire, there's emotional psychological orientation on one of the other points, and then there's what was the third? There's desire, emotion, oh, skill sets. So, you know, you kind of look at that as a strength coach, and you say that's pretty much, you know, that maps out everything you look at, like the skill sets, the physical strength, the mental strength, whatever it is there. Then you've got the guys who have the emotional, psychological orientation, like are they game players? Can they rise to the occasion? How do they deal with adversity? Those you don't necessarily know until you're in the thick of it. And then you got desire. And so as a coach and as an athlete, like in my opinion, like almost everything can be overcome by desire. There are those unfortunate situations when you look at an athlete and you say, holy cow, this kid wants it. He puts the work in, he just doesn't have the skill set to be great. Or for whatever reason, he's just a practice all American. We can't get him to train. I don't, whatever it is, but it still gives you some direction on what to do afterwards. So what I do is when I look at that, I said, like, when you start examining people under this lens, you can build a strong foundation. Your job as a strength coach is to optimize that foundation. You know, not everybody you work with is going to be an All-American. Not everybody you work with is going to be All-Pro or an Olympian or whatnot. But that's the big thing. And so when you start breaking down that foundation into smaller pieces and you start saying, what's really important here? Well, you also have the ability to influence the decisions that your athletes are going to make today, tomorrow, and for the future. And so in the context of my own story, integrity was defined in a specific way. And it was aligned with the Olympic code, the Olympic creed, which in my situation also meant doing the work without any outside assistance, meaning no drugs. And that was something that was, you know, really ingrained in me when I was really young, starting at 15, 16 years old. My dad and I had this conversation, and he basically said to me, he said, son, if you ever do drugs, if you ever do steroids, I'm going to disown you. I have a lot of respect for my dad and my family, and I took him at his word because he's a man of his word. And that meant a lot to me. One of the things that I think I'm most proud of throughout my career is maintaining that promise that I made to him at that, and not even, I only saw drugs three times in my whole life. Maybe I had the threat of it one other time, but three times that I can remember. And in a power sports world, that's pretty remarkable. But that all goes back to what my foundation was built around.
Right.
I surrounded myself intentionally or unintentionally. It may have just happened. I may have been lucky there with people that shared these same values, that understood that hard work was the key to long-term success. Hard work over, you know, a long period of time is going to create those gold medal results. So what I come back to when you're talking about facing adversity is really what this foundation is made of. If you haven't built a strong foundation, you've cut a lot of corners. When you face adversity, it's going to break you. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that I handled my situation well every single day. I certainly didn't live up to the standards that I would consider Olympian, if you will, at times. I can remember after the 2004 Olympics just being completely crushed by that result, because you spend 4 years training for one moment and you're winning the whole competition and you lose on a technicality.
Right.
And then that in the short term, the next year, I lost my sponsor. I was angry at that. I mean, I got so angry. And what I found was, like, I went back to what got me there in the first place, which was hard work. And I had a new level of motivation. So that's one thing that you also have to start working on, is like all of those demons that you develop or incur over the course of your life, they can be positive, or they can positively influence you, or they can break you down. And that's a choice. That's a choice. And unfortunately, so many people make themselves victims of their own demons instead of are empowered by them. My demons, I internalize, and they make me stronger, period. And I may not be able to deal with them perfectly all the time, but over the balance of my life, I will figure a way to channel their potentially damaging side effects and use that to my advantage. Right. Everything you do on a daily basis as an athlete, as a coach, there's always external motivations. this guy cut me off. Well, instead of yelling at him and honking my horn, I'm going to take that energy, that anger, and I'm going to put that in my workout. You know, everything. And it's just a matter of how you start dealing with it. And so when I lost on the technicality in 2004, and then the subsequent fallout of that was like, you know, losing a sponsor, about all this other stuff, you and I were talking beforehand about making sure our passions line up with what we can actually, you know, make money at. I realized that while the sponsorships and things like that make my life a little bit easier, if I went and took care of business and I was the number one in the world every single day, I was still going to make plenty enough money to survive and actually thrive, and I'd be much happier in the long run. So over the course of that year, 2005, I went from training hate, like just where hate, I mean, Matt Vincent would love this, like the hate ran deep inside me those during that year. And then eventually that turned back to passion, not to get cheesy, but like right. I realized hate and anger are not sustainable emotions for me.
Right.
Love, I mean, I have to love and enjoy what I do. And once that transition happened, I never had a bad day again. I lost. I never had a bad day. I never had a lack of motivation. I never felt like if I lost a competition, it's because someone else beat me. It was not because I had some self-inflicted wound or let something else get in my way.
Right.
You know, 8 years after the 2004 Olympics, I get a phone call saying, hey, you know, you were not the silver medalist. You were, in fact, the gold medalist. And what do I have to thank for that? Well, foundations, yeah. Strong foundations. Foundations based on a universal set of integrity, which is, you know, I think the Olympic motto. I mean, I'm not a big believer in the use of steroids and performance enhancing drugs in any sport. I think that that's not pushing your own physical capabilities or your own physical limitations. That's testing what a doctor can do for you.
Right.
My morality is based on the Olympic code, which is to train clean, and there's more to it than that. I think there's a lot of emphasis on keeping a level playing field, but integrity in sports is something that I hold very dearly, and that's a major tenet of it. So anyway, strong foundations.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And you know, so much to pull out of there, but I think the biggest takeaway for me, I think most strength coaches, you know, when you ask them what do they really do, they'll say that they're a psychologist for their athletes as much as anything else. And what that really is helping them understand their emotions and how to use their emotion, you know, in ways that are going to benefit them, but also identifying what their strengths and their weaknesses are and understanding that there's value in our weaknesses and there's values in our strengths and there's detriments in both as well, you know? And,
yeah.
I just had this conversation with my daughter the other day, how she's very empathetic and how she sees that as a weakness, but I was telling her how powerful that can be in certain situations. Right. You know, and I think it's so important, same thing with our athletes, but it can all that foundation can come crumbling down if we don't live our lives as coaches, as a model to demonstrate how, you know, we can make mistakes. Being human is the ability to make mistakes, but owning those mistakes is also mm-hmm. the critical piece with your athletes and relationships and foundations can break down really quick if you fly off the handle, but then you don't turn around and address it, you know. In some way, shape, or form. The other thing I think that, you know, if you've ever seen Adam speak, you know how, I mean, his passion just oozes out of him, but that emotion when he talks about the way he trains, I mean, it's like, you know, like I remember seeing you the first time at the Summer Strong talk. It's like you freaking flipped a switch to a different mindset in a second. I mean, you were like this easygoing guy, and then you went all of a sudden just almost borderline crazy, just demonstrating a squat, and you were able to flip that switch in a moment. I think sometimes as coaches, we challenge. It's a challenge to get our athletes to flip that switch when they walk right into the weight room. You know, what suggestions do you have for coaches to help them with that, to help their athletes be present and in the moment when they do come to train?
Yeah, so. I think the first thing, it goes back to, again, establishing who they want to be. So you set that long-term objective, and you say you want to be this superhuman 4, 3, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, whatever the time frame is down the road. That person is not who you are today. And so you have to start thinking about what that person looks like. How does that person act? What does that person believe? what happens when that person walks in the room? What does he look like? What does he smell like? What does he smell? What does he taste? All these different, and it sounds kind of weird, but this is what I used to do. And I used to do this on my own, but just by probably not with a formalized process. But I would model it after somebody, you know. I watched too much WWF or WWE now, but when I was a kid, but I used to love seeing those guys, whether it was Hulk Hogan or Ric Flair or whoever it was, come into the ring and just own it, you know. And so, you know, when I was little, like 12, 13, 14 years old, like, That was like that visual sort of sign of like, okay, that was what I associated with super intense, you know? And over time, I developed a little bit of a visualization process to get there. And then I had the opportunity to work with a sports hypnotherapist who passed away a few years ago, who helped even formalize the process even more. But at the root of it is, if you don't know what you want to be, you know, you can say, hey, I want to bench 500 pounds. I want to clean 450. I want to squat 700 pounds. Whatever those numbers are, that's great. But what's the point in doing that? Is it just to win a championship? What does it mean for you individually? You got to think more localized, like how you fit in that team. Like, it's great to visualize the team winning a national championship or whatever it is, but at the individual level, you got to get more granular, and you got to be able to look at these athletes, and they've got to look at themselves and say, okay, who is that guy? What is that guy? How do I need to change to become that guy? And you get them to think about that so clearly that as they see it in their head, they can see everything about that person until eventually they can become that person. And I learned, I guess, very early on how to sort of make that transition happen real quick. And it was very intuitive for me. I didn't have to work very hard at that. But part of it is that ability to be very honest with yourself and not give a shit. Pardon my language. Sorry.
No, it's good.
But not give a shit about what's going on around you. Like, a lot of people hold back because they're afraid they're going to look stupid. You know what looks stupid? It looks stupid when an eighth grader walks into a weight room for the very first time and does a bench press or does a squat or does a clean. But you know what looks more stupid? When a guy who sits there and talks about it and says he's going to do all these great things and never takes that first act. So I think it starts from it goes back to that process. It goes back to making sure they're anchoring themselves on who they want to become and making sure that the actions are adding up to whatever that future image of themselves is. And I was just very good at not being afraid to feel like, hey, look, this may look stupid, but I'm going to try it. I mean, even going back to like high school in the eighth grade, quoted Hulk Hogan. I said it several times now, but I used to wear a Hulk Hogan t-shirt. And it was my good luck t-shirt, you know, and people would be like, well, why is that? Because when I get in there, I'm going to be crazy. This is how I'm going to be. I'm going to be this way, right? And, you know, I think once you start breaking down those barriers, you realize that there are so many self-imposed restrictions on what you're physically capable of doing. Like, for example, you know, why is it that a 150-pound mother can go pick a damn tractor off her baby? Yep. Because she's totally focused on the moment and she doesn't give a crap about what else is going on. She's going to save that baby no matter what happens.
Right.
And if you can channel into that sort of focus and that sort of intensity and that sort of rage and controlled rage, really, on a moment's notice, you'd be surprised at what you can accomplish. And it takes a little time to control it, direct it the right way, and not make it an impedance to performance at the higher levels. But that's kind of where I'd start, is sit down, you have the question, you ask the questions, what is it that you want? Who do you want to become? What's the person, when you think about what the superhuman version of yourself looks like, what does that look like? Can you see that person? If you can't see that person in your head, you can't become that person.
Yeah, I like that a lot. I think, obviously most coaches will sit down with their athletes and they'll ask that why question or whatever, but being able to put a visual with it, I think is a critical piece. And then taking the time, prior to put yourself in that moment. So, I'm writing a book right now, or I'm putting together a book right now that's, you know, the 5 minutes before the workout or after the workout, when you're talking to the team about being a quality mm-hmm. human being and stories to kind of help you relate to that. And that 5 minutes before the workout is so critical to me, in setting mm-hmm. the tone and setting the mentality and dialing everybody in and finding ways to do that. And I think it's something that sometimes gets missed where we just go to the grease board and say, okay, guys, here's what we got. Now go to work. It's a lost opportunity. Well,
yeah, it's like, you know, a lot. I think you're absolutely right. So that moment is, to me, akin to that moment where you're committing to get underneath a bar.
Yeah.
I mean, you know how much courage it takes to get under a big bar. Like, when you put big weight on, it's a life or death situation. And you can play it out anyway. We've got the safety racks and all this great equipment, blah, blah, blah. If I put a certain amount of weight on my back or I'm lifting a certain amount of weight on my head, one bad move, one loss of focus, one moment can change the rest of my life.
Yep.
In a really bad way. And I have a whole set of challenges that I never want to have. So I think like that's the message to kids before they go into these sessions. And it doesn't matter if you're going out for a sport practice or strength conditioning practice. You know, when you are competing in a sport, you're training yourself to compete at that one time 110% effort. And it may be a relative term. Like football, you never really go to 100%. There's just too many physical obstacles in your way. But you're still pushing it at a level where you're on the verge of like something's going to break. If you one split second too early, split second too late, something bad happens. You know, and in the weight room, especially when you're pushing into higher intensities, and even not, like even if you're doing more of a 80% sort of relative intensity, if you're out of position and you're not focused on that moment at hand, you can really do some serious damage to yourself. And I feel like that's the same thing when you're getting in, and that's the conversation that you need to have with kids before they get into those situations. Like, look, sports, training for sports, you know, it's life. I mean, it's a life in a completely condensed environment. For the next hour and 2 hours or however long your session is, like, you are going to experience the highs and lows of a lifetime.
Right.
And you're going to have the same sort of threats that you could have. But, you know, the threats are pretty much well known because they're right in front of you. But if you don't take each one of those things seriously, they can hurt you. They can hurt you really bad.
Absolutely. So, I couldn't agree with you more. We've mentioned a couple of times that we talked beforehand about kind of balancing our strengths and our skill sets with our careers, you know, and you've got a great opportunity with what you're doing now to blend your passion for movement and athletic training with your philanthropic initiatives and specifically pediatric oncology with the D10. Explain a little bit about what you're doing now and maybe how some of these coaches that are listening can be involved.
Yeah, so I'm working with a company called the D10, and we put on NFL combine style competitions in 5 markets right now around the country, and we raise money for pediatric oncology research and treatment. It's been an amazingly challenging in a lot of ways and rewarding experience for me. So at its heart, I mean, what we're basically doing is inspiring people to compete in combines, and then using that effort for a social good. But, you know, why do people love, you know, high school sports or college sports or whatever level they make it to? Well, high school or college, at the pro level, it really does become a job, and we all know that, even though nobody likes to say it, but it is a job. There are other motives, but like people love the community. People love, you know, they love the activity. They want to have a bigger purpose. And in high school, it's, this is for the greater good of the school or whatever. Honestly, a little bit self-inflated or overstated, but it is really important. And then my own personal story with it is 2012, I got a phone call from a friend of mine whose son was suffering from a disease called MPS3, Sanfilippo disease. It's a degenerative brain disorder, and there's no cure. His son's going to die of it. And he called and he said, "Hey, can you help me?" And I mean, you have kids. When a friend of yours calls and says, "Can you help my children?"
Yeah.
And all they're asking you to do is do what you do on a daily basis anyway.
Right.
but attach this name to it. I mean, it's like, to say no, like, that's just not human. And so he asked me to raise money using this platform called Charity Bets, which is actually the company that my business partner, you know, the founder of this company, started ahead of time. That's how I got to know the owner of this company. And we ended up raising about $8,000 for his son and for the treatment of, is actually all kids with MPS III. It's a very rare disease. And I had about another $12,000 on the line if I'd actually made the 2012 team. And I had a pretty severe groin pull and really was in no shape to compete. But I went out there and did what I could. And I remember walking off the field and just feeling so horrible that I let my friend down. I didn't care that I lost. I cared that I lost, you know, $20,000.
Right.
For, and you know, I called him and he said, he's like, Adam, he's like, you have no idea what you've done. He said, a lot of people look at these larger, you know, diseases and they say, wow, it takes millions and millions of dollars, maybe billions of dollars to get a cure. He said, but for us, he said, $6,000, $8,000, it moves the dial. And I realized at that moment that sports is a great platform for people to raise awareness and build, really move the dial for people in need. And I hooked up with this company. It's been awesome. We did an event. I apologize. I'm just going to share this story. There was a guy that was competing in our New York event, which is it's been around for 10 years, and it raises over $1 million every year for Memorial Sloan Kettering. And a kid showed up. I say kid, he was probably 26, 27, 28 years old, and he's one of these really bright finance guys. But unlike a lot of the other guys, he did not play college sports. I don't think he'd ever participated in a sport. When I say I had to show him how to do a 5-10-5, when I say I had to show him how to do a pull-up, I'm not exaggerating. I literally had to show him every single exercise of the day. And I finally, and he was so fired up to be there. And I said, man, what did you train at all? He said, I signed up for this 3 months ago because I had a friend whose son, something touched him.
Right.
And it's the same story, basically, a friend whose son. And he said, but it's been really hard. I don't know anything about this world, clearly. He was very self-effacing. He said, but you know what? I've raised $8,000.
That's awesome.
By myself. And, I mean, there were guys that were competing to win the event in our heat. And I'll say this, after they realized what his story was, you saw these guys who were really there to compete. And the fundraising was probably less of a motivator for them. You saw these guys cheering more loud, like cheering loudly, louder for him than anybody else of the day. They were getting more fired up for him doing, like, I mean, we do a 175 rep con. It's a rep test in the bench press. I don't know if he actually got one. And I can remember saying, "Look, I'm going to pick the bar off the rack." And when I say it's your, when you say you're ready, you say it's my bar. And I'm going to say, okay, it's your bar. And I'm going to let go. You know, it's one of those things where you have to grab it. But it was one of the, like, my point in sharing that is, like, I think sports events are a powerful motivator and a powerful way to build community around a greater cause. And we see that, you know, here locally with what J.J. Watt did for hurricane victims. I mean, I don't know what he ended up raising, over $20 million, whatever it was. Just by putting a call to action. That's because people care so much about this type of thing,
right,
that when people, like when they're superstars, ask for help, they feel compelled to take action. And I think that's why I love what I do right now.
That's incredible. And I think it's such a, I think early in your career, you're just so focused on making it and you understand that the potential that you have to touch the athletes that you work with. But sometimes I think it gets lost, the potential that we have to touch not just the athletes, but the communities that we live in and people around the world. And I wholeheartedly agree with you that as coaches and as just humans, we have an obligation to try to make this place better than we found it, you know, and whatever skill set God gave us to be able to have, we need to turn around and use in some capacity. And I commend you. I think it's fantastic. We end the show with some resources here. Give us the best piece of coaching advice you ever received.
Best piece of coaching advice I ever received was from Tommy Lasorda. And not to paraphrase Yoda, but he basically said, losers quit, or losers try and winners do. And that translates in a lot of different ways for him. But the general idea is own your results. Don't talk about it. Just go out there and do it. And if you fail, you fail falling forward, and you get up and you go again. Big, big difference. I know we talk about trying a lot in this country, in this world, but there's a lot of triers and not enough doers.
Agreed. Give us a book, app, and website recommendation.
So I can give you a good book. This is a book that I've read a number of occasions since I was, 10 or 11 or 12, probably 12 years old, and it's sort of a coming-of-age book called Run with the Horses. Fantastic book by a Georgia author. I'm from Georgia. So best app right now, been getting into a lot of, focusing on breathing stuff and meditation and things like that. And I think the Mindspace app is pretty awesome. Best website. I mean, look, this is a Soarnet show, and whether or not you like the website or like their product, you gotta like everything else that they're putting out too. No question. Great people, great product, have had a huge impact on my life. And I think if you can, you guys can, y'all can go look there and find something that, you can improve your, you can really improve your education, improve your weight room, improve your facilities, whatever you need to do, you can find it there. Great people, great place, great website.
Well, brother, this has been fantastic, and I think, like we talked about, I mean, you said in the quote, I mean, losers try and winners do. I mean, here's a guy that has been at the pinnacle of athletics, gold medalist, has coached, has worked with a variety of different people in a variety of different ways, but you're taking those skill sets and you're applying it, right now in something that's going to leave a lasting legacy. Not just with the athletes you work with, but plenty of people on down the line, and that's like I said, it's noble and it's inspiring, and just appreciate you, the person you are, and the way that you're going about your business, and how you're incorporating health and wellness and strength and conditioning into that is creative, unique, and motivating. So thanks so much for coming on the show, and thanks for doing what you're doing, man.
I appreciate it, Ron. Thank you.
That's it for this episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Thanks to this week's guest, as well as our sponsors, for bringing this episode to you for free. Make sure to check out ronmckeefrey.com, where you can join our mailing list, find the show notes, including all the links and resources mentioned, and information about Coach McKeefrey's other products. While you are there, please join Coach McKeefrey in the comments section thanking our guest for sharing. If you haven't subscribed to Iron Game Chalk Talk on YouTube or iTunes yet, make sure to do so. Comments, ratings, and reviews are always welcome. Coach McKeefrey can be found on Twitter at @rmckeefrey, on Facebook and YouTube at @ron.mckeefrey. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk.